ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last, and it is my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud shares his personal tales in and around the wrestling business with all of us. And without any further ado, the man who's going to be taking us on the journey this week, and it's going to be an interesting one this week, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how's it going today?
It's going great, Brian. So glad to be here. Just got my horse all saddled up, man. He's ready to go. And like you said, I think we got a different one for them today. And this may turn into a two-parter. We'll just see how far we can get with it. But I think fans will have an interest in this. This is going to be pretty educational for folks that wonder how things actually work sometimes. And we're going to get into quite a bit of that today.
It's going to be an interesting episode. But before we get there, on behalf of Ron and myself, we want to thank everyone for listening to Super Studcast number 12 with Tommy Wildfire Rich and Johnny Crash Rich. The reaction has been through the roof, and we want to just thank everyone. We know that so many of you have enjoyed the Super Studcast and the rest of the story, but it's still nice to hear from people about how much they enjoy the shows. And Ron, I know you have heard a lot from the listeners in the last couple of weeks.
Oh, yes, certainly have. I mean, they have really taken to Tommy Rich and Johnny, and Tommy was just fabulous in it. I mean, I listened back myself, just laughed like crazy. I mean, He was literally not wildfire. He was on fire, you know. I mean, he just really, really was good. And I appreciate all the fans' reactions, and thanks for the nice comments. And I hope you have an opportunity to listen to it. I think it's pretty darn entertaining.
We'll have more information about that at the end of the show. But of course, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast, only $2.99 for access to the Super Studcast. Well worth it. Check it out. But I mentioned we have an interesting show this week. Where are we going exactly this week, Ron?
Well, Brian, we're going to do something different. We're going to start this is going to be the first part, I think, of a two-parter, and it will be based upon the huge success of the Florida Territory in 1974. This studcast I'm going to call the Building of a Championship Territory, because that's basically what it's about. And my goal is to give fans an extremely educational experience in how a wrestling company should be operated in order to become the most successful business possible. We're going to compare a wrestling company to my two hockey teams that I had back in the late 80s, early 90s. I know that doesn't make sense much until you think about it, because they're both sports businesses. To get a real feel for what I'm talking about, you know, you got to think about it kind of that way. A wrestling territory is the same as a hockey team in a whole lot of ways. Both sports require teamwork, obviously, in the office and in the ring and on the ice. The wrestlers are the same as the players on a hockey team, basically. The booker is a coach, just like a hockey coach. He's responsible for recruiting players or finding your talent, as the case in wrestling, and he calls the finishes. And as the hockey coach calls the plays. Having been in both wrestling and hockey, I really feel that, you know, this is really a great subject for fans. I think that we'll have a great interest in this one. And it's just, It haven't been both of them. I've discovered it. There's a lot of similarities in all different kinds of sports, as a matter of fact. It's not just hockey and wrestling. It's football. It's basketball. Major companies that own sports franchises, they all have to do the same things, basically, to become really, truly successful. It's kind of like having a giant puzzle, and you got to fit those pieces together. And if everyone in the organization is working together and there's perfect harmony going on and synergy within a company, you're going to make it to a championship. And sometimes the championship's not necessarily getting down there and winning the cup as in the Stanley Cup. It can be what you get at your box office and how much your fans appreciate what you're doing and how much they're into what's going on with your hockey team or with your wrestling business. And my personal business is different based upon, and I have my own idea here that I developed many, many years ago, and I call it it's a 10-step approach to being successful. I call it the ladder to success. I learned a whole lot of this in my 4 years in Florida wrestling back in the day, and by building two of the most successful hockey companies of all time in the late 80s and early 90s. 1974, let's just jump right into it. The Florida Territory is going to do what is rarely done. They're going to climb that ladder to success that I'm talking about. And basically, there's 10 steps to this ladder. And the first step is having the right ownership. Just going to go through these quickly, and then we're going to break them down afterward. But you got to have the right ownership. You got no chance if you don't. Second one is you got to hire the perfect booker or a coach. In the case of hockey, you got to have a great coach. Obviously, you got to have a great booker in wrestling. Then the recruiting comes into play. Is the recruiting the best wrestlers? Can that coach recruit the best hockey players, or can that booker recruit the best wrestlers to come in and work for you in your territory? The fourth step is putting those wrestlers and players in the right position to make the company or the team successful. That's a really tough one right there. Number five is selling the product properly, the actual advertising and how you present your product. Very important to success. Step number six is having the key people in key positions. And you place the right people in the right place, and you're going to be successful. You put them in the wrong place, and you're not going to experience. You'll never make that championship, that level. Number seven is always keep the momentum moving forward. Extremely important with sports. You got to have your fans really into it. And number eight is pleasing the fans. You've got to please your fans. And they certainly did it in 1974 in Florida. And step number nine is you set attendance records. That's what the goal is. You want to draw the biggest crowds that's ever been drawn if you can. I managed to do it in my hockey teams. And it was pretty amazing. Never had a championship team, but I had a championship box office figure every night. And everybody in the league was always going, wow, how do you do it? And part of these steps that I'm talking about here is the reason I was able to do it. And the last step is obviously winning the championship. It's not necessarily in wrestling winning the championship. By winning the championship, I mean when it's concerned with a wrestling company, is having your best year ever, just breaking all types of records. And that's why I picked the Florida Territory in 1974, because that's basically what's going to happen here.
Well, let's talk about that, because obviously on the Studcast, we have talked extensively about your time in Florida, 72, 73, all the different things you've done there. 74 is a different animal. Talk about 1974.
It is truly that. I mean, what happens there in Florida is just unbelievable. And we're going to discuss part of that in our program here today. But Watts comes in there, he lights it up. Like a Christmas tree, being that season. I mean, and just, it just goes crazy. And then he works that one tremendous angle with Dusty Rhodes that changes the history of the sport in the state of Florida. So, you know, it's really a, I think it's a great topic because that's a, like you said, 74 is a year like no other in their history. It is their biggest year box office wise, ever in Florida. And, so I'm going to take a wrestling territory and I'm going to use it as a, the example in all these 10 steps to see how you get to produce championship results. You know, I got to start by reminding fans what's happening in Florida and the Georgia territories during January of 1974. Louis Tillette is on his way out as the booker in Florida and Cowboy Bill Watts is coming in. And I've recently won, obviously, we've talked about this in Studcast, and we also talked about it, in Super Studcast. And, I recently won the Georgia title from Watts in December of 73. And in January of 74, I go back to Atlanta and I drop it on Wrestling 2, Johnny Walker. The Atlanta War is in its second year. Wrestling 2 is going to carry the banner for the NWA back Lester Welch and Paul Jones territories until things are going to dramatically change when Jim Barnett arrives in America and makes his move to end the war in Atlanta. There's a transition going on in Booker's occurring for both territories at the same time. Watts is leaving Georgia and being replaced by Jerry Jarrett from the Tennessee territory. Now, Jarrett's learned his trade very well from traveling up and down the road for many years with my grandfather, Roy Welch. And gosh, there's a teacher right there if there ever was one. And Jerry went on to have huge success with the western side of Tennessee, Louisville, Kentucky, everything west of Nashville, basically, Lexington, Kentucky. He just had tremendous success. Now he's going to Atlanta to see if he can do the same thing there.
How often is there a situation like that where you actually have two bookers and one slides in and the other one slides out, but right into another job? From your experience, bookers usually when they're replaced, do they have some place to go?
Not necessarily, because sometimes bookers lose their jobs. And, you know, when you're not happy with the guy that's booking for you, you don't give him a whole lot of you let him know by just a few things that you may say to him. He gets the idea that, man, I may not be making him happy here. But in this case, this is a smooth transition here. Watts is leaving there. Jarrett comes in to take over. Tillette is basically staying there for Watts because Watts is not going to come in right away. He's going to take himself a little short vacation between the two things. And Louis Tillette's going to still stay there. He's going to wrestle in some matches and he's going to handle some things. So let's just saddle her up, man, and let's ride right into the heart of the Florida territory. And let's begin with step number one to success, having the right ownership. Well, you know, Eddie Graham, obviously, he had been the key to Florida's success for many, many years. He came to Florida as a wrestler, and then he purchased the stock of the company years later from Cowboy Luttrell, who had laid the foundation for what was to come in Florida. Did a tremendous job there. Eddie comes there as a young guy, having come out of WWF, working for Vince Sr., a tremendous worker, a sharp mind, great booker, great feel for the wrestling business. And it didn't take him long to decide, I need to become one of the owners of this. I need to get more involved. So Eddie has several partners with that ownership piece that he had. And obviously, Eddie had the largest piece by far. And Lester Welch, my grandfather's brother, Roy Welch's brother, owned a larger piece of the Florida pie than any of the other owners, except for Eddie, obviously. And as we discussed in the earlier Studcast, Lester swapped his Florida territory stock. He swapped his ranch. He swapped his cattle and his horses to my dad, who is his nephew. And then dad, in return, gives Lester his Georgia property and the stock in his Georgia wrestling company. And that's prior to the start of the Atlanta Wrestling War. Now, this made Eddie and my father the primary stockholders of Florida Wrestling. When you consider a wrestling company's ownership as the first step to success, There was probably no territory in the world with more combined experience in the sport than Eddie Graham and Buddy Fuller. Both were close to the same age in their late 50s. Between the two of them, they had a combined 80 years in the ring and actually operated their own very successful wrestling companies. They had experience, just a remarkable amount of them. As a team, obviously, they definitely took that first step up the ladder. They had no problem in doing that. They were compatible, got along, saw the business very much the same as far as how much wrestling you need, how much of fighting you need. It was just a great combination.
You've talked a little bit about it in the past here on the Studcast, the different things your father has done outside of wrestling. And I know a little bit about Eddie, but Ron, can you tell us a little bit about the successes they had in other businesses outside of professional wrestling?
Well, they had tremendous success in other businesses, and Dad kind of got into real estate way back when he first started wrestling, and he started making his money on the Gulf Coast wrestling down there in Mobile, and bought himself a farm, and he realized how to make money with real estate. He bought a farm that he had to go in and clear with a bulldozer, and sold the farm for a tremendous amount of profit because it was just a bunch of trees, 300 acres of trees, turned into four houses, a huge barn, three lakes. I mean, he just did a beautiful job of setting that up, and he learned from that. And when he goes to Tampa and gets involved with Eddie, Eddie gets into, he understands and he knows Dad's success with real estate. And they start talking about Florida land. And that, you know, is just, this is back in the 70s. So you can imagine the prices that land was. It was fairly inexpensive.
This is Walt Disney's company actually was buying up all that land in Central Florida, too.
There you go. And hiding it because they didn't want them to know that they're buying it, you know. So everybody's price goes up. Well, Dad and them were smart. They didn't just stay in the Tampa area. They went into cities like Gainesville and Ocala. They were buying property in country areas, and Dad still had bulldozer, and he was taking those bulldozers and knocking trees down and building lakes on those things and then turning them over for huge profits. So they weren't having just success in wrestling, but they were having tremendous success in real estate. And now in 1974, I think they're going to make more money from wrestling than they're going to make from real estate simply because of the what they're accomplishing and what they're doing. So, you know, let's just take step number two. I mean, you need to hire a perfect booker or a coach. If it's a hockey team, you want the best coach you can get, and obviously you want the best booker you can get. Now, their decision to hire Bill Watts as a booker was not a difficult one. I mean, Watts had proven he was a proven star in the ring and as a booker. So he's not just a talent being a booker. He's going out there in the ring and getting it done, too. The job he did in Atlanta is just unbelievable. As a successful booker for the NWA Georgia territory was really amazing, especially if you consider the competition started with almost every established wrestler that he had in that company, deserting him and leaving him only Bob Armstrong and Darryl Cochran. Amazing what they were able to do. That would have probably decimated and put most companies right out of business, that one thing, taking your talent that you had established already and them ending up in someone else's hands and working against you. So he managed to succeed in the face of almost insurmountable odds. Now he's going to come to Florida. And he's poised for success here in an established territory. He's got no competition there, and he's just determined to set records. I mean, the conversations we had, he's saying, Ron, I'm going to blow it apart. I'm going to make it fabulous down there. And so the Florida territory is definitely then taking that second step with Cowboy Bill Watts. They have hired the guy that at this point in wrestling, I think, is maybe the best booker of all.
Bill Watts was given 10% of the Georgia office to go there and book when the war broke out. He retained that 10% of the office until he sold it to Ole Anderson in 1982. I believe Bill Watts has stated that Eddie told him he was also going to get a piece of the Florida office when he came down to book in Florida. And I don't think that did happen. But the question begs to be asked, though, Ron, how often did a booker actually get a percent of the office?
Oh, geez, that's the only time I'm aware of it, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, bookers get paid, and they get paid pretty good money. But when you start cutting a booker in for part of the profits, it's a good idea in the respect that he's going to work extra hard, because if it draws, he's going to make even more money. That's a big decision to make, to give your booker part of your business. And I was really surprised that Georgia did it. And I didn't know that it didn't happen for him in Florida. I've never talked to him about that before. But, you know, that's a big step because, you know, he can only do so much. And he's probably, if he's a good guy and a good person, he's going to work his hardest at making it successful, because he's going to keep the job. He's going to make more money, especially in Bill's case. He's wrestling every night, and then he's getting that booking fee at the end of the week. He's getting that extra check for booking. And in George's case, they had some pretty darn remarkable business from 74 to 82. That's 8 years of pretty decent money that he made there off of that 10%. And kudos to Bill. That's why he's sitting over there in Florida Panhandle and just enjoying himself, man, because he made some wise decisions and he did a great job as well. Let's jump into step number three, recruiting the best wrestlers or players. That, you know, not only does your booker have to be good at what he does, but he has to recruit his people. He has to recruit his talent. And if you're a coach, you've got, in the East Coast Hockey League that I was in, your coach has to find all these players. He goes into Canada. I don't know how he finds all those players back in my first team in Nashville, Tennessee. But he comes up with a pretty darn decent team. And so Watts accepts the booking job in Florida, and he takes a short vacation after dropping the Georgia title on me. And he's not going to arrive in Florida until mid-January of 1974. He's going to have him a 2 or 3 week vacation. Louis's going to handle the booking and the finishes and working some of the shows until Watts gets there. Now, once Watts gets there, he's a smart guy. He takes a back seat. He quietly takes over the book. Quietly, I say, for a couple of weeks, and he surveys a whole lot of things. Smart bookers do that. They don't jump right in until they see exactly what's going on for themselves. They want to know their talent. They want to know what's going on. The fans weren't even aware he was there, because he's not booked on any of these shows, and he sneaks into the matches after they start in all the towns that he goes to. For the first month, he doesn't do this for just 1 week or a few days. He doesn't actually go into the ring for a month. So he's keeping a low profile, and he's doing it intentionally. He's going to become a huge star in Florida in the coming months. But he's smart not to jump straight into the ring and push himself as soon as he arrives. Good bookers, especially those who's going to be wrestling as well, they take their time. Because at this stage, he doesn't want to alienate any of the existing crew. Sometimes bookers get that, they get anxiety among the crew because they push themselves. And so he doesn't want to do that. He's want to sit back, and he wants to take his time and getting in there and really taking the reins here. Because he's not sure who's over. He wants to keep whoever's good, and he's going to give a notice to those that he doesn't like. He's going to have to find out who's been working together and how long they've been working together. And have they worked these long programs together? What angles has been worked and used there? And he's going to have to find out if he's going to be able to create a rapport with some of these, the existing talent. Does he want the existing talent? He doesn't even really know who he wants to push and who he wants to eliminate from the existing crew. He's got all these questions, like every booker does that goes in to take over for somebody else. He's got to have answers to all these questions before he can really do the best job for them.
How scary is it to be in that locker room when there's a booking change?
It's a horrible, it's a frightening affair. I mean, you know, you're there, your family's there, you may have been there for a long time, you got a great relationship with the booker, bang, he's gone, there's a new guy comes in, he doesn't know you, he maybe never seen your work. And right away, you're thinking, well, hell, he's not going to keep me, you know? So what happens is the guys that are there in these existing crews, they're going to work extra hard because they're trying to impress Watts at this point. They want to get his favor because they want to stay there, you know? So, I'm going to take the next step here. You know, before I start introducing some of the stars that are presently in the crew, when he arrives there, okay, I'm going to break it down to who was there and who was leaving and who's going to be coming. Okay, so he's and I got to thank a great friend of mine and associate of yours and mine, Arcadian Vanguard member, just like I am, Barry Rose. He has provided me an extensive list of all the Tampa matches for 1974. Without his assistance, I'll be honest with you, I'd be lost and have literally no clue at remembering the names of all the wrestlers who were there at that time, much less who the heck they were booked against. So thank you, Barry, very much for your help here and for all you do, man. Barry Rose is a great historian for Florida wrestling. I just really admire Barry and respect Barry. And thank you, Barry. You make this easier for me, and I think it will make it a lot better for the fans of the Studcast with your help today. So I'm just going to barrel on here, okay, Brian? I'm just going to rip into her, okay? So here we go. We're going to take off here with the wrestlers that's in the Louis Tillet crew before Bill Watts arrives in 1974. You have Eddie and Mike Graham. You've got Paul Jones. You've got Dusty Rhodes. You've got Buddy Colt. You've got Joe LaDuke. You've got the great Malenko, Dick Slater, Haystacks Calhoun, Don Curtis, Rip Hawk, yours truly, me, I'm in that group. And there's a host of underneath talent, guys that work televisions and can be thrown on the first and second matches and too many names there to be mentionable. It's a pretty remarkably good crew, I think, to be in that territory at a time when Watts as a booker goes in there. He's got to look around and go, wow, you know, they got some pretty good talent here. But he's the booker, and he's going to handpick who he wants at this time, you know. He's going to take – and he's going to look for guys that he thinks can take things to a new level. He wants to push it from what he talked to me about. He wants to push it beyond anything ever done in Florida as far as crowds are concerned. Now, he's going to accomplish this by working the best turn – of a heel to babyface, maybe in the history of the sport. And that's going to be the Dusty turn. It's not going to happen in the first couple of months. It's going to take Bill a while to get acclimated, to get his crew in there, to eliminate those he doesn't want. A lot of things have to happen. But he is going to accomplish an unbelievable feat because no angle in the history of Florida wrestling that I can think of is going to surpass the angle turning Dusty babyface.
Well, Ron, that's the talent that was there. What was the changeover to that earlier question I asked you? What talent came in once Bill Watts became the booker?
Well, some of them started arriving in early 1974. Gary Hart basically is one of the first to come. And he comes under a hood, and he's wrestling at that point in his career. He wrestles as a wrestler called the Jackal. Great name for Gary Hart. Pretty appropriate, actually, maybe. The first week in February, he's going to arrive. In January, there are no new people for Watts. He's taking a good look at what's there, but he's already making decisions of where he wants to go and some of the things he wants to accomplish. And Gary Hart is not going to be brought in there as a wrestler. He's going to be switched from a wrestler to the manager of the, I call him the Axis of Terror, you know, and that group of guys that he's going to get put together is going to inflame the Florida fans, and they're going to torment Dusty Rhodes before he turns babyface. They're going to torment him, and then afterward, they're going to try to kill him. And that's the way fans are going to see this program as long as it lasts, and it's going to last for a long darn time. Kevin Sullivan is going to stay. He's going to start the same week as Gary Hart. He jumps into the mix. Bill Watts himself is going to start in mid-February, and his first match is going to be in a tag match with me, and we're going to be against a guy called the Psycho and the Super Texan, and we're obviously going to get a win that night. And we're going to wrestle in a lot of tag matches early on in Watts' appearances in Florida. Tony Charles is going to come the week after. And then later in February, Buddy Roberts and Jerry Brown, the Hollywood Blondes, are going to come in. They're managed by Sir Oliver Humperdinck. They're a fabulous tag team. And Humperdinck is, you know, one of the most rotund, and that's a pleasant way of saying a fat little dude, loudmouthed and despicable managers of all time. They're going to start in early March. Now, these seven guys that I've just mentioned will soon be followed by others. It's going to be an amazing thing that happens in the first 3 or 4 months of 1974. Don Morocco is going to soon arrive, Pak Song, the Korean Giant, and there's going to be a lot of others, and many others are going to come join in the coming months. This is where he begins to build Florida's biggest, I'm calling it the championship year. They're going to be the Super Bowl champions, the Stanley Cup champions. They're going to be the biggest, best territory on the planet in 1974.
There is some footage, but not a terrible amount. And of course, he passed away young before videotapes really became the thing. Tell me about Pak Song. What was it like when you first saw him work? And just how effective do you think he was? What about that look that he had? Tell me about Pak Song.
Pak Song was scary. First time I saw Pak Song, he reminded me of Baba. He had the same head. He had that big head that Baba had, and had a look to him that was really, really big. He had a great chop, and he would pulverize guys. He really was impressive, and I'd never seen him before. When he arrives in Florida, I had not been in wrestling in Korea. I was offered the opportunity, but I didn't want to go to Korea, to be honest with you. And Pak Song he comes in, he goes under Gary Hart wing. He's going to be one of these Axis of Terror guys that are just tormenting not just Dusty, but the fans in the state of Florida, too. He's a perfect fit for what they're about to do and how they're about to work it with Dusty.
Ron, Florida is a unique territory because obviously it's always warm. So a lot of wrestlers, maybe they're wrestling in Minnesota, maybe the Northeast. The idea of going to Florida in the middle of the winter was probably a really alluring thing. Talk to me a little bit about that, the guys who would show up just for the winter.
Well, okay, that's a great one. You know, there's a phenomena in wrestling for the state of Florida, and it's totally unique. There's no other territory probably in the world that has that. What happens for Watts is he's going to get a plethora of talent that's just going to stampede into Florida as they do every winter. And he can pick and choose who he wants to book. He can book them on nights he wants. It's easy and sweet for him. He has there's a lot happening in the territory every winter because so many wrestlers, as you say, are from the north, and they can't wait to spend some time in the deep south, especially in that warm winter weather down there in Florida. So I want to give everyone an idea of just what caliber of talent these wrestling snowbirds, I call them, are that make themselves available in January of 1974. You got to bear in mind now that Watts cannot use all these guys in his crew that he's planning on building his business around a certain group. He can't use all of them, but the Sunshine State's weather is certainly going to provide him with some great talent to get his incoming stars over. And some of those incoming stars that are wintertime guys may earn spots, and do. Some of them do, and Watts' new crew, because they work very hard. And once he sees them start to get over, He may decide, I'm going to take this guy rather than the guy I was going to take because he's already over. So here we go, man. Hold on to your cowboy hats out there. We're going to talk about, wow, this is what happens in Florida. These are the guys that come and don't stay very long. Some of them stay longer. Mad Dog Vachon and his supposed brother, Stan Vachon, not his real brother, but Stan Vachon, good worker, both of them. Mad Dog only lasts 1 week, but Stan stays. He's one of those guys that Bill kind of likes, and Bill tags him up with Dick Slater, and when Mad Dog leaves and Stan's there by himself, they go together as a tag, and they're gonna be the Florida Tag Team Champions by the 1st of June. Joe LeDuc's going to welcome his brother Paul. Well, Paul is just like old Joe, and a pretty darn good worker too. And they're going to team up, obviously, when Paul shows up in Florida, and they're going to win the tag titles in January, and then they're going to lose them to Vachon and Slater in February. And shortly after they lose the titles, Paul's going to disappear. And Joe LeDuc's going to hang on there as talent, because he's such a good talent, and he's going to do his best, work hard as hell, and he's going to remain there. He's not going to be eliminated from the crew right away. He's going to have himself a little spot there. The incomparable Danny Hodge, World Junior Heavyweight Champion, is going to come in and stay for 4 weeks in January, from January into February. And on his last match there before he leaves, he's going to unmask Gary Hart, who's the Jackal. Then Gary Hart turns his role over into being a manager after Danny leaves. But Danny has a great relationship with Bill Watts, and Danny comes in not just to wrestle for Watts, but to help Bill and to offer his advice to Bill. Danny's an old veteran at this point, and Bill puts a lot of stock in what Danny feels about guys. And so it's going to have a big bearing on what choices that Bill's going to make for talent, as far as talent is concerned. And then after Gary gets unmasked, his run in 1974 is just going to be unbelievable, long and powerful, as the way I'd put it. Tex McKenzie manages the last 4 weeks before Dusty eliminates him in the Southern Heavyweight Championship match. Haystacks Calhoun, that refereed my Georgia title match with Watts in Atlanta, stays for about 3 weeks. In January, he disappears. George McCrary, pretty good worker out of Oklahoma, has some amateur background, makes it 3 weeks in January. He's gone. Bob Orton and Bob Orton Jr., father and son, last about 2 weeks in January. They're gone. Dennis Stamp, an up-and-coming young talent, man, manages to make it 1 week. 1 week, and he's gone. Ali Vasari, Tom Jones, Ron Michalozak, Big Mac, Frank Martinez, Skull von Troheim. It goes on and on and on. They don't even make it a week. They're there 2, 3, 4 shows, and bang, they're gone. So it's like a bloodbath of talent coming and going, like there's a giant turnstile at the Florida border that's letting wrestlers in and then rocketing them right out. You know, I'd never before seen anything like that as long as I've been in wrestling. So obviously step three is being taken, because this booker, he has no problem recruiting wrestlers, and he's making all the right choices.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ron, before we get to step four, this seems like the perfect time to take a short break and tell the listeners a little bit more about Super Studcast number 12 with Tommy and Johnny Rich, as well as the rest of the story, the special Christmas Day edition of the rest of the story. Check this out right now.
The Super Studcast number 12 is shattering records for Super Studcast at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Wildfire Tommy Rich is really on fire in the first hour of part one, and his cousin Johnny Crash Rich is the perfect southern gentleman that fills in all the holes that Tommy left open in the second hour. It's both hilarious and historical, and it's a must hear if you're a true wrestling fan. The Stud has made these 3-hour Super Studcasts great. great for any old school fan or extremely educational if you're a new fan. All 12 Super Studcasts are now available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99. If you're a patron, be sure to catch the last hour, rest of the story, on Christmas Day, December 25th. What a great way to spend your Christmas Day. And Merry Christmas from the Stud, the great Brian Last, and everyone. Studcast Central. I'm David Summers from the great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee.
There it is, Super Studcast number 12 with Tommy and Johnny Rich, as well as the rest of the story on Christmas Day, all available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. We encourage everyone to check those shows out. If you enjoy the Studcast, you certainly will enjoy the Super Studcast and the rest of the story, only $2.99. Tell a friend. But before we get there, let's get back to the story, Ron. You were about to start talking about step four of your 10 steps to success.
Yeah. And step four is basically it's putting wrestlers or the players. And if you're a hockey coach, as an example, you in the right position to make the company or the team successful. Gosh almighty, that right there is a critical and crucial part of being a coach or being a booker, is you have to assess talent and you have to figure out where this guy fits in. If you're a coach on a hockey team, should he be playing center or should he be a defenseman? And then you've got to figure out what combinations, if you've got you're a hockey coach, you got those three major players and your two defensemen on the ice, and you've got to pair those three guys. There's a whole lot involved in making this part of it successful. Wrestlers are not normally team-oriented, as you can imagine, because they are on a team. They actually are on a team. And the bookers are like coaches. They deal with different personalities in different ways. So they're pretty much like a coach is for a hockey team. All wrestlers know that if they refuse to do what they're asked to do, especially on a regular basis, that they're going to be looking for another job. Now, Watts is a well, I don't really know how to describe him in these terms. He's overbearing. I mean, he's solid on what his thinking is, and he's not willing to take much crap from anybody. Okay, so he's also adept at deciding who fits at the top of a card and where everybody goes below that. You know, he's been around. He's done it so many times. He's had great success. So he's going to happen. He's going to make it happen for Dusty. What he does with Dusty is just going to be proof that's going to be certainly that he's qualified for making those decisions. Because we're going to discuss that turn. We're not going to talk about Dusty's turn here at this point because it's too early. It's not close enough. I want to build it for Super Studcast fans so that they can see what's happening as this goes along during the course of 1974. But it's a thing of beauty. They're setting up an angle that's going to change history, change the wrestling history of Florida forever. So if you look at it, step four, then it's a given then that Watts definitely knows where to place guys and who to put over to make the company successful. That's one of the steps that has to be taken to not just be involved and running a business, to your business being top line and you're potentially reaching that championship year every year.
What's step five, Ron?
Well, step five, I guess, is, it's selling the product or the sport properly. We're getting away now. We've talked about what the booker can do for you, how important the owners are and how important the booker is and all of his jobs and what makes it happen if your booker is doing very well for you. And we're going to step in a little different direction here for number five. we're going to start talking about selling the product or the sport properly. And this has been a strong point for the Florida Territory for many years before Watts arrives. He's not going to have any responsibility or any part in this selling of the product. That's going to come from Eddie. It's going to come from Dad. It's going to come from the man. I'll get to the man in the middle when it comes to selling Florida wrestling. There's no other, no comparable person to what this guy does. But Eddie makes some great choices. I mean, he gets the right people to work within the office structure, handling his advertising. They run great ads. They run them in cities all over the state out of an office in Tampa. Very rarely done that way, and not done as well as they did it for darn sure. So he's got good people in his office handling his advertising. And then more specifically, his best choice for who is the guy that should handle a commentary for his television show. And by gosh, he selects the best in the darn business, in my opinion, or certainly one of the very best, Gordon Solie. And Gordon just rocks the television. I mean, Gordon is just, he's totally involved in the production of it, in the interviews. He communicates constantly with the camera crew. He even can give them, he had ability to give the camera crews notice sometimes early to be ready for a shot. Get this, get that, close up. You know, he could be doing his thing and directing at the same time. Just an amazing guy when it came to doing television. And then he made some super decisions that's going to add to the power of each one of those broadcasts that he is. He made the decision to start shooting film long before anybody else ever did it. They were shooting film in live arenas. And that has such a profound effect on your production. It's just unbelievable how good that looks to fans. You've got a television studio, and they were still doing it in the old snake pit down there. And you could put probably maybe 150 people in there, but it's not like that 8,000-10,000 that you've got in the West Palm Beach or in Miami or Jacksonville Coliseum, Tampa down there in the Armory. I mean, you've got these sold out buildings, and the impact of seeing these videos in those days, there was no video. 74, they were shooting with probably 16 millimeter or whatever it is, the film product, and then coming back and playing them on the program. It was just magnificent concept. It was really good. And I adopted some of those techniques myself. I got to be honest, when I started Southeastern Championship Wrestling in Knoxville later in this same year, I'm going to be having my own company, and I'm going to be responsible for what kind of television program I'm going to have. And I'm going to take some ideas from Eddie. And one of those is to shoot things from the live arena. Nobody sold the product better than Gordon, and the television show itself is years ahead of most territories in the country, or productions worldwide for that matter. There wasn't anybody that could compete with their product, I didn't believe, so far as their television program. So I guess we're about halfway through the 10 steps here, and you have any questions about any of that?
Well, yeah, we'll cover, obviously, you said it'll be a two-parter, steps 6 through 10 next week on the show, but Ron, you briefly went past a few of the guys you worked with. Can we talk about some of the matches you had over this period of time in the first few months of 1974?
Yeah, I wrestled. Now, we talked on the last one. I was wrestling Harley in one of the last two supers of the regular stud cast, and I was wrestling Harley. And I get booked in Tampa with Harley again. Now, Jack is the champion. On this same night, Jack is defending the world title, and I'm working with Harley semi, or maybe even two matches down from the main event. Harley's an unknown, a fairly unknown product in Florida. He's been there, been through some in preparing him to be champion, but we go out and have a tremendous match. And actually, we go through. It's a 30-minute match, and we go through, which is a piece of cake. Working with Harley and doing 30 minutes is not a problem at all. And pretty much tear the house down early in the night. That particular card was just loaded with some fantastic talent. So they're already drawing now. This happens in February, and they're already drawing full houses pretty much every night, but it's going to explode and go beyond anything anybody can imagine. Watts and I work with the Super Texan and a guy called the Psycho on Watts' first night in there. And we have a tremendous match with them. Bill and I never worked tag team before. He wants me to work partners with him, and I'm very happy with that. I mean, he's the booker, and he's going to be pretty on top, and I'm going to be in a good spot there. And we're friends. We spend a lot of time traveling together and talking together. We're creating a great relationship, Bill and I, at this point. And Bill's going to turn on me. Down the road, it's going to be another big angle. Everybody that he brings in and all the guys that he's going to have, all the angles that he's going to do, he's going to be one of those type of bookers that I really become myself, and my brother grasp it like Bill does. He's got something happening for everybody on the card, and that's really unusual, and it's what it takes to just captivate the fans all night long. You can sit in that dressing room and hear him pop match after match after match because they look forward to the next one. There's a reason for that match, and he was exceptional at getting that done. And another match I have, I have a Florida tag match, with the great Malenko as my partner. And we wrestle Stan Vachon and Dick Slater, who are the Florida tag team champions. Great match. My golly, Malenko's over in Florida, been there for so many years. Fans just love him. He was fabulous as a heel. Now he's a babyface. They just love him. And he does the normal things he does. He used to do the old stomp. He would get somebody down on their back, and he would start stomping. He'd stomp their ankle, and he'd stomp their knee. He'd stomp their thigh. He'd stomp their stomach. He'd stomp their chest. He'd stomp their head. He'd go all the way around them and stomp, 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 stomp. I was like, wow, I watched it. I was like, whoa, it's really something to work with different guys like that. And we had a phenomenal match with them. Obviously, Slater's a great worker, and so was Stan Vachon, a great worker as well.
Is that where Ron Garvin got the stomp from?
It probably is. I'm pretty darn sure he did. I've never seen anybody do it. I'd seen Ronnie Garvin do it some, but this was 1974. Yeah. It's before Ronnie starts doing it. I don't think Ronnie does the stomp much until he comes to Knoxville with me in 75. So, Ronnie probably picks this up from Malenko, and it's an unusual move, and it's just part of what Bill is piecing together here. Early on, it's already doing very, very well. He's eliminating the guys that he doesn't want to keep, that doesn't have a future, that don't fit in with his concept. And he's bringing in the others from this point on, into March, April, May, they just continue to come, just rolling in there one set after another. And, it's just an exceptional time to be a wrestler in the state of Florida in 1974. And probably you'll be very lucky if you ever see wrestling be as hot as that again in your lifetime.
The Super Texan who you worked against was a young masked Austin Idol early in his career. What was he like in the ring at that point?
Well, he's not Austin Idol. He's bulkier, much bulkier. And he doesn't move around real well. He doesn't have, Now, he's a heel, obviously. Austin, as he goes through time, becomes a better babyface, in my opinion. He has a lot more fire as a babyface than he did as a heel. And this is Dennis McCord, not Austin Idol, and it's a different animal. He's slower. He's not as he doesn't take as good a bump. He's just not the worker that Austin is going to become a little later in his career.
Who was the psycho, Ron?
I'm not sure. Be honest with you, I don't remember. I don't remember who that was. There was so much talent coming in and out. I did not know who the Jackal was when I first watched him. You know, I didn't realize that that's Gary Hart. You know, so they're mixing up and matching different people. There's so much going on, as you could tell, with all this guys that are coming through in the wintertime because they just want to hang out for a little bit. You mix them in. You've got a pretty decent crew already. Then you start bringing in Watts, new guys. Those dressing rooms were full of wrestlers. Every city, when you went into the town, you couldn't find a place to put your bag because they're just coming from everywhere. And it was a great time to be a wrestler. It was exciting to be a part of it because you kind of got a feel, even before they turned dusty, that something big is going to happen in 1974 in Florida.
One final question for me this week, Ron. Bill Watts was a major babyface in the Northeast in the mid-60s, and then he turned on Bruno. And that changed everything. All of a sudden, him and Bruno had a major program. He was the biggest heel in the territory. Him and Bobo had a major program, especially in Washington, D.C. But it was the turning on Bruno after he had been his friendly cowboy friend that really, really got him over the top. Did he talk to you about that at all? Because obviously, when he's teaming up with you with the intention of turning on you at some point, it's in many ways him redoing that angle that got him over to the next level in New York. Did he ever talk about that with you?
No, he never told me his intention, and we worked long enough to get the Florida title. We had our hands on the Florida title at one point, and I think it was right about in that point that he comes and says, I need to switch. I need to turn here. And I'd had no problem with it because it obviously meant I was going to be able to work with him, and he's a top guy. And I'm pretty much a top guy in the territory at that point, too. I've been the Southern champion. Within the next month, I'm going to be, for the first time ever, the Florida heavyweight champion. So he's going to take care of me. Bill is really going to take care of me. He uses me very well, makes me his partner. And by turning on me, he really puts more steam on me in a way. And so I had no problem with it, but he did not tell me. We never sat and talked about his angles that he did with Bruno and what he'd done with Bobo. And I hear that Bobo thing was pretty scary.
Oh, that was really intense at that time. It was a racial angle, obviously, that Bobo and Bill cooked up, and people really believed it and went with it. But one last thing I want to ask you, Ron. This period of time, early 74, the last several weeks, especially on the Studcast, we tracked an interesting year for you in 1973, where you were all over the world. In early 74, if I had to ask you, how good was Ron Fuller at this point, and what did Ron Fuller still need to improve at this point?
I'm getting pretty good at this point. I'm still going to St. Louis. I haven't mentioned St. Louis in this program, but I'm still in St. Louis. In fact, you mentioned Bobo. I'm in a tag team match with Bobo as my partner, Bobo Brazil. I'm almost a two-territory guy at this point. I'm in Florida 5 days, and I'm in St. Louis 2 or 3 days every other week. And I'm still getting better. I just kept trying to get better all the time and putting a lot of emphasis on it. What helps me and is going to help me is the Pack songs and these different type of guys that he's bringing in. And I'm going to get my shot and my chance to wrestle against all of these different guys, Bobby Duncum. There's going to be a lot of good workers come in that I'm going to have the opportunity to keep improving my game. And I really put a lot of emphasis on trying to do that constantly. I feel like I'm a better wrestler in 74. But, you know, Brian, I'm still not the Tennessee stud yet.
Well, certainly not, and I can't wait till we get there. How were your promos in your eyes at this point in time in 1974?
I make a pretty decent promo. I've had pretty good run at it here. Even when I started in 1970 in Florida, they're working me in Fort Myers a lot, and they have a television station down there, and I'm on top working with Ronnie Garvin and guys like that, and I got to do interviews. So I've been doing interviews since the day I went in the ring, and that doesn't happen for a lot of guys. They may work 2 years before they ever have an opportunity to say a single word on television. I was already making interviews 3 months in, and had it consistently, was able to do it pretty consistently. And my interviews is pretty good, but I got to go back again to what I just said. I was not the stud yet.
All right. All right. Well, I can't wait till we get there and find out when you do become the stud. Of course, that will be in 1974 when you go to Knoxville. But Ron, as we wrap things up, before we get to everything else, I know you've been excited about this. The brand new DVD set that you have, Southeastern and Continental, The Lost Territory, available at tnstud.com. Anything you want to say about this to the listeners?
Oh, yeah, I do. And Brian, I am really excited about it. This is the DVDs. They're going to be sold in 5-packs. There are just, I've seen them. I've seen them all. Gosh almighty, I forgot how good it was. I forgot how much stuff we were doing with Southeastern and Continental during that time frame. These matches, this is an official release. Vince doesn't own this program. These programs are not owned by anybody. My brother and I and Bob Armstrong and the people involved in those companies are this is our special release to fans. And what we're going to do is we're going to sell them in 5-packs. The first 5-pack is 12 hours of wrestling in it, 67 matches. And it's got everybody. It's got Hulk Hogan before he was Hulk Hogan, and he's going to arm wrestle Andre the Giant, the original angle that put them together for the first time ever. It's got Shawn Michaels, WWE guys. It's got Bob Armstrong and all the boys, all of them in there. It's got, obviously, my brother and I and Jimmy Golden. It's got Tommy and Johnny Rich. It's got the Nightmares, Jerry Stubbs, Adrian Street. Wendell Cooley, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. The amazing number of people and very, very, very good quality for back. Some of these matches are for back in the mid to late 70s and 80s. It's Southeastern and Continental both. And I'm very proud of them. And if fans would like to get them, yeah, they can go to tnstud.com and just click on the stud store. And the very first thing you're going to see is these 5 DVDs. And they're $39.99. And for the first 200 people that order these, you're going to get a free 8x10 photo that's autographed by Rob and I that will come for free. And that's like a $30 value. So it's a $70 value. You're going to get for $39.99, and people can go there, and they're available now. And, you know, I just, it's wonderful for me to be able to watch it again. I had forgotten how good some of our stuff was. Really, really, truly amazing stuff.
Well, it will be the Lost Territory for not very much longer, because I think more and more people have been discovering Southeastern and Continental over the past several years, and more people will discover it now. Once again, tnstud.com. And you also get to answer the question, when you get an autographed photo from the Fuller brothers, who signs it the Tennessee Stud? Is it Ron or Robert? Find out when you get the new DVD set, Southeastern and Continental, The Lost Territory. But as we wrap things up, we want to remind everyone that they can become friends with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook. The page, Ron Fuller, The Tennessee Stud. Of course, you can follow the Tennessee Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts, classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. We mentioned it earlier, Super Studcast number 12 with Tommy and Johnny Rich, as well as the very special Christmas Day Rest of the Story, all available at any time at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 to access these shows. And once again, here at the end of the show, we said it at the top of the show, thank you so much to all the patrons of the Studcast and all the listeners. We really, really do appreciate the feedback and the tremendous response these shows keep getting. And on that topic, Ron, I assume we know, but where are we going next week on the Studcast?
Well, we're going to finish. We're going to finish the last five steps, and I think those will be interesting for fans, and we're going to get more into more matches, and we're going to pick up a little St. Louis again. We're going to kind of go all over the country like I was doing in 1973 and 74, a little bit of everything from everywhere.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.